loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Walter Smolarek, sitting in for Brian Becker, and joined in studio by John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at three big stories. First, the Supreme Court held constitutional the Trump administration's travel ban. Meanwhile, the head of Border Patrol is saying they're no longer referring people seeking asylum for prosecution. We'll talk about the ongoing national upheaval over the country's immigration policies. Then, the Syrian government said today that Israel fired two missiles that struck targets near Damascus Airport this morning. Meanwhile, fighting in the south intensifies as the battle for control of one of the armed opposition's last strongholds gets underway. And then we continue our weekly Tuesday series, False Prophets, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism with Daniel Sankey. Today we discuss all things trade, as well as the administration's bid to merge government departments in order to eliminate important programs, as well as the Koch brothers' work to eliminate public transit projects nationwide.
But before we get to those three stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, whistleblower Reality Winner agreed to a sentence today of 63 months in a federal prison on one felony count of espionage. She was accused of providing a document to the online news service The Intercept. In contrast, Jeffrey Sterling had seven counts of espionage and received only 42 months. Winner's sentence is especially harsh, and it's a harbinger of things to come from the Trump administration. Next, the European Union withdrawal bill has formally become law in the UK following a delicate compromise between the government of Theresa May and both houses of the British Parliament. The legislation enables EU law to be transferred into UK law, and it repeals all previous laws that allowed the UK to join the EU in the first place. It's one of the final pieces of legislation necessary to implement Brexit. Then Iranian President Hassan Rouhani promised that the government would be able to handle the economic pressure of new US sanctions a day after traders demonstrated outside Parliament to protest a sharp fall in the value of the national currency, the rial. Those sanctions are due to take effect soon. And then, have you ever been to Brooklyn Heights in Brooklyn, New York? It has a fantastic view of Lower Manhattan. One of the most imposing buildings you see is the AT&T building. It's a skyscraper, but it has no windows. Why? Well, according to The Intercept, it doubles as a secret facility for NSA. And apparently, there are other such AT&T buildings in most major American cities, including Washington. And finally, the Supreme Court yesterday ruled on two highly anticipated gerrymandering cases in North Carolina and Texas, saying that most of the controversial maps in both states will be used in the upcoming election. The ruling allows three of the four Texas districts to stand and all of the North Carolina districts. And in other headlines, Vice President Pence will go to Guatemala this Thursday to talk about immigration to the U.S. with the presidents of Guatemala and Honduras and the Vice President of El Salvador. He's currently in Brazil meeting with President Michel Temer, who came into power after the parliamentary coup that ousted Dilma Rousseff. Department of Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen will join Pence in Guatemala for the talks. The Congressional Budget Office issued a report today with a dire warning about the fiscal health of the country. The CBO report stated that the federal budget deficit will hit record levels within 16 years, higher even than during the Second World War. The CBO cited tax cuts combined with the rising cost of programs used mainly by the elderly as main factors contributing to this phenomenon. U.S. prosecutors today charged a Standard & Poor's ratings analyst and two others with insider trading. Sherwin-Williams company purchased Valspar in a $9.3 billion transaction, and the analyst let two friends know about the pending purchase in early March 2016. They allegedly made about $300,000 off the deal by buying Valspar stock before the transaction and selling it after. Voters are headed to the polls across the United States today as the primary election season continues. Elections will be held in New York, Utah, Oklahoma, Maryland, and Colorado. In Utah, former Republican presidential candidate Mitt Romney is hoping to secure the nomination for a seat in the Senate. And the race in Staten Island is particularly bitter, with two voters facing a choice of Republican Michael Grimm, who just finished a prison term for tax fraud, and Republican Representative Dan Donovan for a congressional seat. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and clear.
Now we turn to the latest developments in the fight over immigrant rights and the Supreme Court decision on the Trump administration's travel ban. We're joined from Philadelphia by Sundrop Carter. She's the executive director of the Pennsylvania Immigration and Citizenship Coalition. Welcome, Sundrop.
Thank you for having me.
So let's start with a travel ban ruling. It was a close ruling, 5-4 to uphold, to let stand the travel ban on majority Muslim countries, with maybe one or two exceptions. Well, how do you react to that? What do you think that means for the state of the country?
I think this is a very disappointing decision. You know, we have been fighting to stop this Muslim ban since the, you know, first one was announced in January of 2017. And I think it's disappointing that the Supreme Court has decided to uphold that and give tacit support to this administration's, you know, anti-immigrant and xenophobic agenda.
Yeah, the basis of the legal challenge to the travel ban was that it was motivated by anti-Muslim animus, that basically the statements made by Donald Trump on the campaign trail demonstrated that, you know, regardless of what he says now, that the core motivation for this was discrimination on the basis of religion. Do you agree with that? I mean, what evidence do we have that shows that the administration's argument that, well, this is just a purely security measure without regard for religious status is incorrect?
I mean, I think we can see this president and this administration has been very clear about their motivations from, you know, the day that Trump announced his presidency, when he, you know, called Mexicans names. Throughout his campaign, he has consistently targeted immigrant communities and refugees as being criminals, as being bad people, as being problems. And, you know, every single immigration policy that he has put forward has reinforced this. And, you know, I think one of the things that this shows is a real weakness in our legal system, that, you know, we put preference on the letter of the law without understanding the context and the impact. And this is one of those situations that, you know, maybe not within the four corners of the policy as it is written or the executive order as it is written, doesn't say that it is trying to discriminate against Muslims. But it is very clear that that motivation exists. And if you look at this administration and this president in totality, it is very clear that they have a racist and xenophobic agenda. And this policy is part of that.
I want to talk about the politics of this, too, because, I mean, everybody in America knows that almost all of the 9/11 hijackers came from Saudi Arabia. Yet we sell the Saudis billions and billions of dollars worth of weapons every year, and they sell us billions of dollars worth of oil. And so the Saudis are not on this list. How does the White House go about justifying something like that without looking like hypocrites?
Well, I mean, I don't know that this White House really cares if they look like a hypocrite.
True.
And I also think that this is where, you know, racism and xenophobia are not logical. And if we try to apply logic to this, we miss the point, which is this is really about othering a whole group of people. And if it's in self-interest or economic interest not to choose one specific country, that's fine, because really this is about creating a narrative and perpetuating a narrative that immigrants are inherently criminal and inherently dangerous, that Muslims are inherently criminal and inherently dangerous. And this is more about perpetuating that narrative, even if the specifics of the policy aren't logical or linear in what they do.
You know, the first time I ever went to Yemen, I was meeting with the U.S. ambassador there, and he told me something that was fascinating. He said that the U.S. embassy was responsible for distributing 50,000 Social Security checks every month in Yemen. This was 50,000 Yemenis who had, for the most part, moved to Michigan. They had gone to work for General Motors or Ford. They worked a 30-year career, retired, and moved back to Yemen because they were originally from Yemen and their money would go a lot farther. This is 50,000 people from one of these purportedly dangerous countries that came here, lived law-abiding lives, and then found success and went back home. So the dangerous people that the White House wants to believe make up, you know, the majority of would-be refugees are so few as to be minuscule, as to be where you couldn't even count them, to tell you the truth. But again, I point to Saudi Arabia. What was it? 17 of the hijackers were from Saudi Arabia or something like that? 16 of or 17 of the hijackers, and nobody ever wants to talk about the Saudis.
Yeah. Well, you know, I just want to, you know, our country has a long history of involving ourselves in the politics of other places for economic and political reasons, and then don't want to reap the consequences of that. So whether that's, you know, our involvement in the politics and economics of the Middle East, or whether that's, you know, sticking our fingers in the politics and economics of Central America, you know, we're very willing to intervene. But then when those places are, you know, have droughts or economic crashes or whatever it would be that would force folks to, you know, flee their countries and seek refuge somewhere else, like the United States, or, you know, maybe justifiably say, why is the United States meddling in our politics and harming us, and then be angry at us? We're not interested in dealing with the consequences of our actions. And I think this administration has done an excellent job of demonizing and criminalizing immigrants without, you know, and hiding the fact that, you know, we are in fact part of the reason why a lot of this happens. And again, whether this is, you know, folks seeking refuge from Yemen or Iraq or Iran, where we have long histories of intervening, or whether this is, you know, Central Americans coming to our border, where we also have a long history of intervening, you know, this is just yet another continuation of this administration's clear anti-immigrant and anti-refugee agenda to keep people out based upon, you know, racial and economic lines.
And even before this executive order from the Trump administration, which was just now upheld by the Supreme Court, I mean, it's very difficult to get your refugee status approved by the United States government and U.S. authorities, right? I mean, part of the, you know, so-called national security argument that the Trump administration is making is that, well, look, they presented like there's this flood of people coming in. We just have no idea who they are, right? I mean, that Donald Trump says literally that. We have no idea who these people are.
Which is a lie, by the way, because they're all investigated and vetted.
Yeah, right. Yeah, so Sundra, talk about some of that. I mean, it's actually the United States has a pretty embarrassingly non-generous refugee policy considering its role in the world.
No, absolutely. I mean, even under the previous administration, Obama had only recently raised the number of refugees that the government would accept up to something like 100,000 a year. It was very low. And one of the first acts that Trump did was lower that to accepting, I think, 45,000 people a year, which when we look at the number of displaced people in the world, so the number of people who have had to flee their homes because of economic or environmental crises or military crises, you know, it's in the millions. And yet we, as one of the wealthiest and most powerful countries in the world, only accept, you know, under 50,000 of those people and provide support. And I think it's, you know, that's a disappointing on many levels. One, we have the resources and the ability to do so. And two, from a human level, you know, how can you look at a world full of suffering and say, no, we're not interested in helping. We're not interested in helping make the world a better place. You know, you guys go deal with that problem on your own, but we're happy to take your resources, but please don't tell us about your problems.
Let's turn now to the broader debate going on over immigrant rights in the United States. We're talking with Sundrop Carter. She is the executive director of the Pennsylvania Immigration and Citizenship Coalition. We've been talking about the Supreme Court ruling on the Trump administration's travel ban. Sundrop, it's been a while since we last talked. There's, you know, protests going on all across the country on a daily basis. You know, now high-level Trump administration officials are being, you know, publicly rebuked, you know, wherever they go, at restaurants, at clubs, at bars, whatever. How do you react to all this? I mean, it's a pretty impressive ground surge of pro-immigrant, you know, solidarity with immigrant communities.
No, it is very heartening to see folks turning out and being angry, because the administration's policy around family separation was truly horrifying. And I guess my hope is that people will continue to stay engaged. One of the realities on immigration is that, you know, U.S. policy on immigration for decades has been family separation, right? That is whether it's refugee resettlement, where it is extraordinarily difficult for people to bring family members over, maybe people they haven't seen in decades, whether it's how we accept people at the border. Like, our policy has always been family separation. This is just a particular, or the pulling children out of the arms of their parents at the border is a new and particularly heartless and cruel version, but is certainly not a new policy or new practice. And I guess my hope is that people will educate themselves and take action and continue to stay engaged. For example, here in Pennsylvania, we have been the home to one of only three family detention centers in the country. And, you know, it is also the only publicly owned detention center, which means it's not a private company that owns and operates it. It's public property that's leased to ICE. And yet our public officials from the county all the way up to the state level have turned a blind eye and said, you know, it's so sad that there's two-year-olds in jail, but we can't do anything. When in fact they do have the power to shut the doors and tell ICE, you know, we can't tell you who to hold in your custody, but we can make sure you're not practicing these inhumane policies in our state.
Well, that's all the time we have left. We've been joined from Philadelphia by Sundrop Carter. She is the executive director of the Pennsylvania Immigration and Citizenship Coalition. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for Brian Becker and joined in studio by John Kiriakou. The Syrian government said today that Israel fired two missiles that struck targets near Damascus Airport. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, while not confirming the strike, said that Israel would do anything to protect itself, implying that perhaps this was an Israeli strike. Meanwhile, fighting in the south intensifies as the battle for control of one of the armed opposition's last strongholds in Syria gets underway. We're joined from the San Francisco Bay Area by Rick Sterling. He's an investigative journalist and member of the Syria Solidarity Movement. Welcome back, Rick.
Yep, good to be here.
So two interconnected things going on here. There's this offensive in the south, you know, one of the last pockets of control outside of the government, at least outside of the area controlled by the YPG, supported by the United States. And while this offensive is ongoing, Israel carried out yet another one of its airstrikes. Talk about these two developments. What's the significance?
Well, I think Israel is continuing to provoke the situation. They don't want to see the conflict end. They want to prolong the bloodshed there, actually, and prevent the Syrian government from finally defeating terrorism in Syria. So they've acted for many years now as actually a protectorate of the terrorist groups. There's an ISIS contingent, there's a Nusra contingent, and there's other groups calling themselves moderate rebels or Free Syrian Army in southern Syria, up near the Israeli occupied Golan Heights. So they've been actively involved in the conflict from the get-go. They've medically treated terrorists inside Syria, inside Israel, and with Benjamin Netanyahu going along bedside, video showing him greeting medically treated, you know, extremists. And then now at the same time, we've got for weeks now, the Syrian government, as well as the Russian allies, have been urging the extremists in southern Syria to reconcile, to basically give up, and either be transported to another part of Syria or to reconcile with the government, as has happened in other areas. So they've been urging this. It was very successful in Ghouta. The death count, the bloodshed there was vastly less than was predicted earlier on. And the civilians ultimately welcomed the Syrian government back, and that's what's going to happen in southern Syria as well. So the next few weeks are going to be very, very critical, I think.
You know, if this were a purely military question, then I think it would be a relatively simple thing for the Syrian army, given the current balance of forces, to go in and capture the city of Daraa and other areas of the south that are still under rebel control. But it's not a purely military question. I mean, to go back to the old cliche, war is the continuation of politics by other means. And it's the political factors that are really complicating this fighting in the south. So you talked about the Golan Heights, right? So the Golan occupied by Israel since 1967. That's in the south, right? That's, I mean, internationally recognized as part of being, you know, sort of the south tip of Syria. Israel has been saying, well, look, if Iran, if Hezbollah, if they're present in the south, then all options are on the table, you know, threatening war. Do you see something spiraling out of control here?
Well, I'm not sure. Israel uses Iran as a pretext. Basically, they're attacking Syria. They're not attacking Iran. They always claim that they're attacking, you know, armaments headed for Hezbollah or armaments from Iran or Iranian contingent. They've exaggerated the Iranian participation in the conflict from the start. And there are Iranian militias that and military advisors in Syria. That's not secret information. They are very open about that. But the attacks, the rockets that were launched after the attack from Israel a few weeks ago, those were not from Iranians. They were from Syrian military forces. So that was a signal from Syria to Israel saying the old days where they have just they've basically accepted the attacks on Syria without retaliation, those days are over, and the Syrian government is prepared to launch mortars into Israeli-occupied territory or into Israel proper if Syria is going to continue to be attacked by Israel. So it is a dangerous situation right now. We don't know what the calculations in Israel are, and it's pretty hard to predict what the U.S. is going to do. There's competing wishes within the U.S. military and CIA and the national security establishment. A few weeks ago, the U.S. issued a kind of a blunt warning saying don't try to take back the south of Syria because we're not going to allow it. But more recently, just in the last few days, the U.S. administration has wisely walked back from that, and they sent a message from the U.S. Forces in Jordan to the extremists in southern Syria. They don't expect us to come to your support. So they've clearly indicated the U.S. that is has indicated they're not going to. They're not going to intervene militarily in support of the armed factions in southern Syria. And I think that's what the Syrians are counting on. I mean, this is really very clear cut under international law and the United Nations Charter. The U.S. doesn't have the right to determine whether a sovereign state can remove extremists from its own territory. That's how clear it is.
Since the beginning of the Syrian war in 2011, which has caused so much suffering, hundreds of thousands of people dead, you know, a whole society, just the fabric of it ripped up. Ever since this conflict started, the United States has been looking for, I think the United States has been looking for a reliable proxy force, right? I mean, certainly they've made alliances with all sorts of different armed groups, many of which have an extreme right-wing religious orientation. But they really needed a force that they could call their own. And the south of Syria was, I believe, the staging ground for a lot of those efforts, particularly the presence around Tanf, which is close to Daraa, also in the south of Syria. But it seems like there's a realist, going back to what you're talking about in terms of the factionalism within the U.S. establishment about what to do with Syria. You know, it seems like there is a faction that developed as the war dragged on that said, okay, well, we'd like to have regime change. We would like to overthrow the Ba'ath Party government. However, that seems unrealistic. And now the best we can hope for is, in their view, the best we can hope for is the partition of Syria. And so we're going to support the YPG, the People's Protection Units that fight in the predominantly Kurdish areas of the country, now sort of rebranded with some alliance partners as the Syrian Democratic Forces, will partition the country. And that's our strategy, a realistic strategy, rather than regime change, which appears not possible anymore. Do you think that sort of strategic difference is what's undergirding this debate about the importance of the south of Syria?
Well, I think you're right that the U.S. is now on option B, what John Kerry called option B, which is if they can't overthrow Damascus, well, they'll just start dividing up the country and partition it. I mean, I think it was John Bolton that talked about Sunnistan years ago. They've promoted this as a conflict, as a sectarian conflict. Initially, it was characterized as being peaceful protesters against brutal dictator. These were all wildly inaccurate. While there were various grievances, there was a certain amount of popular opposition to Assad. There was also a huge support for Assad, and there was a violent element in the protests from the very start, which was right down there at Daraa. Terrorists came into Daraa, which is on the border with Jordan, supported by the CIA, and they had a hand in killing seven Syrian police and burning a municipal building right on the first weekend of protests. So that's something that's been, there's been a lot of misinformation about the beginnings. But right now, what we're seeing is if we look at the patterns from the past, we can expect to see a lot of media sensational claims and fears about civilians being attacked, civilians being targeted, and a very horrible events about to happen. But if we look at what actually happened in Aleppo, in Ghouta, in Homs before that, it's pretty much just the opposite. The number of civilians is hugely exaggerated. Most of the civilians left, and they're actually in Jordan now. There's a huge refugee camp in Jordan with almost a million people, that a lot of those people came from Daraa, and some of them came from Ghouta around Damascus, and they're now moving back. There's Syrian civilians who've been in Jordan sometimes for years who are now moving back into Syria as the Syrian government has recaptured areas. So I think we can predict there's going to be a lot of media talk in the weeks ahead. And there's another element to this which may be significant. If we look at the patterns of U.S. geopolitical strategic moves, they frequently coincide with big international events. For example, the coup in Kiev, Ukraine, took place in the closing days of the Sochi Olympics. In February 2014, go ahead 2 years to the Rio Summer Olympics, and there just weeks before the beginning of that, there was this huge sensational stories and a huge outcry and accusations of state-sponsored doping in Russia, which led to the banning of the entire Russian track and field team. Subsequent examinations, and this hasn't been reported, has revealed that while there were some complicit athletes, that 95% of the Russian athletes who were accused have been totally cleared. So that's not in the media. But my point here is that we've got the World Cup going on in Russia right now until mid July, and I think the West is very, they don't want to see a successful World Cup in Russia, if you get right, put it in the most simple terms, and they may create some kind of an event. The Russians have predicting another chemical weapons false flag attack for the last week or two. So I think there is a real danger of something like that happening. Of course, the Syrians have absolutely no motive to do that, but the Western media doesn't seem to care about that.
We're going to have to leave it right there. We've been joined from San Francisco Bay Area by Rick Sterling. He's an investigative journalist and member of the Syria Solidarity Movement. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
Today, we continue our weekly series, False Profits, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism with Daniel Sankey. We're joined from San Francisco by Daniel Sankey. He's a financial policy analyst. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
So I want to start with something that's making headlines today and last night, the increasingly public dispute between Donald Trump and Harley Davidson. So Harley Davidson was, you know, Donald Trump embraced them, but now they're fighting each other. What's going on?
Well, what's happening is Harley Davidson was under some retaliatory tariffs from Europe. And so Europe, in response to a number of tariffs that the Trump administration imposed on them, had retaliated. And they'd actually targeted some very specific sectors of the U.S. economy and some very specific companies. And it's believed that the reason why is they were targeting companies which are big and influential in areas in which Trump's base lives. So rather than target the U.S. in general, the European Union appeared to be targeting sectors of the United States that were supportive of Trump.
I'm fascinated by that. But it's true. That's exactly what they did. Things like soybeans and Harley Davidsons and blue jeans and stuff like that.
Yeah, exactly. It was actually very clever, frankly. Rather than understanding this to be a war of the European Union against America, they seem to be very carefully sending the message that this is a war of the European Union against Trump. And I think the European Union is smart because they understand there are powerful forces in the U.S. who are very opposed to the trade war, who want to see these sanctions or tariffs placed on the European Union lifted. And so they're playing to that. They're letting those forces know, hey, we're on your side. We understand this is America as a whole. The downstream effects is because of these retaliatory tariffs, Harley-Davidson is being hurt. You know, their profit margins are being really cut into. And they're talking about moving their operations outside of the U.S. or certain aspects of their operations, not the entirety, so as to avoid these tariffs, so that they will effectively, those different operations will not be a U.S.-based company. And so really what's happening is this trade war, as we can see, some of the very early effects is it's pushing commerce outside of the United States, and it's hurting U.S. companies so that, you know, they're trying to protect their profit margins. So rather, of course, than, you know, making America first and America strong and creating jobs, et cetera, which is the rhetoric that really brought Trump to the White House, we're seeing the exact opposite, that the workers are being hurt as different capitalist enterprises scramble to try to find ways around these tariffs.
Daniel, the president has tweeted a couple of times today about Harley Davidson. I want to read a couple of them. He says, when I had Harley Davidson officials over to the White House, I chided them about tariffs in other countries like India being too high. Companies are now coming back to America. Harley must know that they won't be able to sell back into U.S. without paying a big tax! And then he says, a Harley Davidson should never be built in another country. Never! Their employees and customers are already very angry with them. If they move, watch. It'll be the beginning of the end. They surrendered, they quit. The ARA will be gone and they will be taxed like they've never been taxed before. What's the legality there of threatening to tax a company like they've never been taxed before? If I were the CEO of Harley Davidson, I'd move the whole kit and caboodle to Canada.
Yeah. Frankly, I mean, I wonder about the legality of it as well. Like, you know, can you really just target one company and say everyone else's tax rates in your industry is this, but for you, it's special, it's extra high. And the reason is I'm mad at you and we're having a fight. You know, it seems insane and kind of, you know, challenges the idea of private enterprise, of course, which is that these companies want their capital to be able to flow freely to wherever they see it as most profitable. And in this case, Harley Davidson is starting to see it as more profitable outside the U.S. because of tariffs. Also, you know, there's this image. Harley Davidson is one of those companies like Coca-Cola or Budweiser that's just like synonymous with America. You know, it's just a super American brand. And the idea is that because the president is fighting with them, they're being forced to leave America. It is not a great image for this administration. And I would imagine it really pushes back on those supporters that feel like Trump, you know, really truly is supporting America and believes in the United States. Now he's kind of at war with the brand of America, in this case, Harley Davidson. So, I mean, it's all over, you know, it's what we've gotten used to with this administration, right? These ridiculous confrontations that are sort of like some kind of bad reality TV show. And I'm not even sure he'd be able to pose specialized taxes on Harley-Davidson. I really doubt the legality of it because, you know, if it wasn't to be opposed by the courts, then of course Harley-Davidson would very quickly go to the courts, then it could set this ridiculous precedent where the chief executive could just kind of pick and choose which company he wanted to do business with or not.
Thinking about the big picture in terms of trade wars, I mean, there is an argument that a government that wants to impose tariffs could make to the leaders of big businesses about why it's a good idea. And it's basically, well, look, we're going to suffer a little bit in the short term, but in the long term, our common interests are best served by going after a competitor, right? A country that threatens our economic predominance. And so to maintain, you know, the United States capital, right, writ large, right, you know, U.S. businesses' predominance over the world, we have to take trade measures against like X, Y, and Z countries. But I don't think that the leaders of the major corporations in the United States trust Trump to manage their common interests like that, right? I mean, it's a very high stakes game when you take on both the European Union and China at the same time, even though, you know, the CEOs might be sympathetic to the idea that, well, we want our economy and our businesses to do well at the expense of theirs. Trump isn't the guy who they're going to follow into battle, is he?
No, not at all. I mean, for big, huge, sweeping moves that this administration is making, there's a way to do it. There are a whole army of bureaucrats and lobbyists that you get involved with. You have long, involved conversations with CEOs and executives at other companies. You take your time. You have follow-up meetings. You make guarantees. You make promises. And then you start moving forward. And even then, you do it gradually. And the idea is for these CEOs, for these, you know, massive corporations, they want stability. They want a predictable, stable playing field that allows them to make their profits and worry as little as possible about government action. And the Trump administration is completely unwilling or perhaps unable to do this. They've shown that they're going to be motivated more by ideology than by kind of political reality. They have a particular agenda that gets pushed no matter what. And they're willing to fire or sanction or tariff whoever they feel stands in their way against that. And exactly, these CEOs simply don't trust him, even if he was willing to go backpedal a bit and have these meetings with them and grant them guarantees. I don't think they trust him. I think that they've seen just too much chaos for them to feel safe around any kind of promises made by this president.
I think the bullying is a problem, too. I mean, that's really what it comes down to. You invite people over to the White House, you tell them everything's going to be great, you enact policies that make things not great, and then when they do things to protect their own shareholders, which is exactly what they're being paid to do, then you're threatened with higher taxes and being run out of business. It just doesn't make any kind of sense to me. It just seems very impulsive.
Yeah, it is impulsive, but I think, and what I've said in other shows and just recently, is that, you know, this administration isn't motivated by a particular kind of political calculus like previous administrations, where the idea was preserve capital formation, strengthen American economy, preserve the buildup of wealth, the rise of money to the top 1%, and manage all the contradictions and chaos that is inherent in such a system. And the Trump administration isn't really motivated by that, which is in part why the administration is so unpopular with its people in high places. Their motivation is a very specific ideology that was kind of articulated by people like Steve Bannon and others of this very hyper-nationalist tribalism, this sort of America turned in on itself, separating itself out from the world as a way of ensuring the continuation of our, you know, kind of civic identity. And this is very contrary to, you know, decades of U.S. foreign policy and is really motivated more by an ideological thinking about the United States than it is by these kind of practical business concerns that have normally occupied the presidents previously. So that's why, you know, it is impulsive and it is kind of destructive and chaotic, but it has its own internal logic. And this administration has shown to be very consistently following that ideological internal logic. And there's really no reason to think they're suddenly going to stop.
Let's turn to a different topic that you had flagged for us. Earlier this week, there's been a lot of talk and late last week, too, about a proposal to combine the labor and education departments. What do you think is motivating such a proposal?
Yeah, so this is actually a really interesting development. The current administration is proposing this massive overhaul in the federal government. And really, it's a sort of merging of a wide variety of different previously separate departments. And that will have really sweeping effects, which, you know, all we can take time to talk about. You know, the Department of Labor, the Department of Education, really there's this significant shift in the fact that it will, the Department of Education will be less focused on higher education and will become focused on job training and job skills. This idea being that education is for the creation of a labor force that will benefit corporations, that will ensure they have access to a steady supply of labor with very specific skill set that they want, as opposed to the idea being that, you know, U.S. citizenry should be educated and have access to information and have the opportunity to pursue higher education, you know, in the cause of enriching both themselves and society as a whole. So this is a huge change. This has been kind of the trajectory of U.S. education over the last 20 years or so. So this isn't out of the blue, but this is a very significant change because it shows this really important shift in what these departments will be doing. And what they'll be doing is creating job skills, not creating access to higher education.
I mean, what could those job skills even be, though? Because it seems like what's driving, you know, this growing tide of both unemployment and underemployment and people just dropping out of the workforce is automation, is the growth of, you know, machine learning and artificial intelligence. And I mean, how could this merger like what are people going to do?
Yeah, well, I think that the idea is that especially right now we have this really tight labor market. There's all these kind of retail and service sector jobs that are in high demand in the sense that they're kind of running out of a labor force. They're still low pay, minimal benefits, and people don't really benefit from them. But under the current job market, there's, you know, a slight increase in wages and competition due to this tight job market. A lot of what this will do, and, you know, this happened where my father was an educator in high school. He's a math teacher. And there were certain tracks within high schools where kids, rather than kind of doing this sort of broad general education where they're exposed to a lot of different things, would have this very kind of focused educational track, which was really on preparing them for working in a particular sector, such as the hotel industry or the retail industry or food prep industry or something like that. This is kind of what's happening there, only on a macro scale at the federal government, where there's this idea that, well, we need all this cheap labor and we're kind of running short. And really, these are more and more the jobs that automation hasn't yet touched. So there's still a need for human capital, for human labor. And this will, you know, the goal is let's create this workforce of these particularly kind of lower skilled employees so that we can ensure that these corporations can have access to them until, of course, they develop the technology needed to automate them. It's a really disturbing turn of events because education historically has been about preparing an educated citizenry, people that can engage in civil society, engage with government, engage in politics. They're critically thinking, they're educated, they're capable, and that everyone should have access to this information. Everyone should have this opportunity. And this merger is changing that focus entirely to something very different that really will hurt people and hurt our society in the long run.
I think the saving grace really is that Democrats condemned it virtually as soon as the press release was issued from the White House. And the Republican response on Capitol Hill was so tentative that I think we could probably bet money that neither the House nor the Senate will even take it up. I'd be surprised, frankly, if it even gets out of committee.
Yeah, that's what I've read as well, that pretty much they lack the support to get it through. And if there's one thing this administration is bad at, is generating sufficient support and creating consensus. So I would like to believe that as well, John, that this is probably a kind of a long shot. That being said, though, I worry. I think what this administration has been good at is proposing legislation or, you know, new departments that are so far right, so far afield that, you know, everyone says, oh, no, this is way too much. And then they walk it back a little bit so that people then get on board and say, well, it's not as bad as what you proposed before. And then we end up with something further to the right. You know, so that has been an effective strategy that they've engaged in before. So what I worry is that they'll say something like, okay, we won't do the merger this way, but we'll do it this other way, which shifts it further to the right as a way to get people to say, oh, okay, well, that's not as bad. But, you know, we'll have to wait and see.
You know, we were just talking about the debate over immigrants' rights and immigration in the United States. And during the Obama administration, everybody was protesting against family detention, like how cruel it is that you lock up a whole family, you keep them in these detention centers, some of which are privately run. And now, after Donald Trump completely separated families and acted this unbelievably cruel, quote-unquote, zero-tolerance policy, now that's the demand of the Democrats to have family detention centers. So I see what you're saying. I think that dynamic plays itself out in a lot of different ways than it could in this, you know, proposed federal department agency revamp. I mean, what do the education and labor departments do anyway? I mean, I think a lot of people don't really have much interaction with them, unless, of course, you're paying publicly subsidized student loans.
Yeah, absolutely. So really what these departments are created to do is to provide federal assistance to, in the case of the Department of Education, to students so they can gain access to education. It's supposed to fund and incentivize public schools and public centers of higher education at the universities. It's supposed to, as you said, subsidize loans so that it can encourage private lenders to loan out more money to students. It covers regulation that allows access to these different institutions. It looks into issues around accessibility based on race and ensuring that other marginalized groups have access to these things. So it does a lot. It's really the idea, we have this idea that we should have public education, right? And that's why everyone gets to go to high school for free, quote unquote, for free. I mean, obviously our tax dollars are used to fund it. And so these departments really are to provide that sort of state guarantee that we have access to these certain things. And with the Department of Labor, kind of a similar idea in that the labor force is provided benefits, protections, re-education as, you know, markets changes, they get reskilled. And also it has a lot to do with kind of coordinating, cooperating with the union movement, which incidentally, that was an important change too, that they mentioned that the word labor is kind of being struck from these different departments and replaced with the word workforce, or at least that's the proposal, which is a really kind of, granted it's just nomenclature, but it's a really kind of clear indication of the ideology here. CEOs, corporations, they like the term workforce. They hate the term labor because labor has these old union connections, you know, of a mobilized workforce that's fighting and demanding their rights. And of course, this just shows the general tenor of these changes. So really, these departments benefit a tremendous amount of people, and they're a huge part of why we, until recently, have had an educated citizenry with access to these different things. And we're seeing that more and more getting eroded away, and this merger is part of that erosion, this rolling back of all these public benefits that we've kind of taken for granted for so long.
Daniel, I'd like to turn to the Koch brothers. You know, people talk about the Kochs all the time. They're prominent billionaires. They are very generous with Republican and conservative causes. They also tend to be libertarian on some issues. They're actually really good on alternative fuels. But there was a fascinating piece in the New York Times talking about their opposition, very well-funded opposition, to public transit projects around the country. What's that all about?
Yeah, there was an article that was talking about this, and really it was talking about these kind of law voter engagement efforts by the Koch brothers to try to scuttle proposals in different communities for an upgrading or just outright building of public transportation. Naturally, to do this, this would require taxpayer revenue to be diverted in that direction, and in some cases, potentially raising tax rates. And so there was a big push by them to try to, you know, overinflate the costs and the significance of these tax increases in an effort to try to scuttle these efforts to build more public transportation. You know, it's interesting because the particular organization that they sponsor, Americans for Prosperity, you know, argue that, oh, all this public transportation wastes taxpayer money. It's on unpopular, outdated technology like trains or buses. And it doesn't matter because we're all moving towards these clean driverless vehicles, which apparently somehow we're all going to be able to have access to, which has yet to manifest. And really, if your concern is around the environment and is around, you know, the fight against climate change, these heavily centralized public transportation is a far cleaner and simpler way of moving people around. I mean, I think of my BART system here in the Bay Area moves about, 450,000 people a day when it's a work day. And that's a huge amount of people that are now not on the road with cars that are using this single train, which uses tiny amount of energy and fuel compared to all 450,000 cars on the road. And it's really just, frankly, dishonest and unfair. Yes, I'd love to live in this utopia where we all have access to these clean driverless cars that we can all just jump into. But right now, Teslas are extremely expensive and your average working people can't buy them. And there's really not a whole lot of options outside of that. And frankly, that's to say nothing of all the congestion, all the wear on infrastructure, the traffic jams and all these cars cause. So, I thought this was an important thing to bring up because, the Koch brothers aren't certainly by themselves on this. There are many other conservative actors that are really fighting against these different public initiatives, which, benefit so many people. I think of, when I visit other places with even better infrastructure in the Bay Area, like New York City, the public transportation is incredible and cheap and compared to the Bay Area, at least. And it makes me so upset that there's so much wealth and money here in the Bay Area that is available to us. And yet there's not enough political will to use it on public transportation, to update it, to expand it, to give people more access to it.
I think this question of public transportation is closely related to another big economic issue that people are facing in their day-to-day lives, and that's the question of housing and the ability to find affordable housing. If we want to really step back, since the 1973 economic crisis, which was resolved, I think, primarily by shipping, mass manufacturing and heavy industries off to oppressed countries where you can pay workers very, very little money, they had to, the people who own the economy in the United States had to come up with a new formula for the accumulation of wealth. And that was FIRE, right? They came up with this acronym FIRE, finance, insurance, and real estate. What are we going to do with all this capital that we earn all around the world? Well, we're going to invest it in large part real estate. And so that's led to skyrocketing property values, especially in cities all across the country. And that led to this, phenomena of massive gentrification that so many communities are suffering from. As a consequence of that, people have had to leave the core of cities and are pushed further and further out, either into the outskirts of metropolitan areas or outside of, urban centers themselves, into the near suburbs. And as a consequence, really rely on not just, the core public transportation that you can find in any major city, but some of these further out bus lines, these further out train lines that are usually the first ones to be cut when, billionaires like the Koch brothers come in and try to push these types of policies. There's really a lot of layers to this, right?
Absolutely. I mean, and you think about that circumstance, that migration out of the city. Well, why is that? Well, it's because they can't be paid a living wage, or their employers refuse to, so they have to live somewhere far outside. And yet they're the ones spending the time and money to come into the city to produce that wealth for their employers, to be that low paid labor, to stock their shelves and sell their goods, etc. And what this is saying is, yes, even though they're producing all this wealth, even though that they're benefiting so many people and being so underpaid, we don't want to even give them the quote unquote luxury of cheap public transportation so they can easily get in here, which is ridiculous. They want to work. They want, a job and a life. They can't afford to live in that area. And just like everyone else, they pay taxes. So, this is just another example of kind of working people being squeezed out more and more, as this process kind of grinds on.
In our last 5 minutes here, let's turn to the SEC. There's an article from the Wall Street Journal you flagged for us. SEC probes whether companies rounded up earnings per share. What does that mean, and why is it important?
So why this matters is the SEC engaged in a probe of all this data they collected from the balance sheets of large corporations. And what they found was a lack of a particular number, and that number was the number 4. And why that matters is the number 4 means you round down because it's less than half of, which is 5. But anything 5 and up, you get to round up. And what they found and what they're investigating and alleging essentially is that it has become a common practice against many companies to round up to the nearest cent on their balance sheets, to simply raise the number up to a full penny rather than dropping it down one penny. Now, you know, our listeners might think, so what? It's just a penny. But when it comes to all these corporations and when it comes to massive amounts of capital, it's potentially millions of dollars. And so what the SEC is doing right now is investigating whether these companies essentially are misrepresenting and inflating their earnings, making their earnings appear to be much higher than they actually are by this kind of quote-unquote creative accounting by rounding up. I thought this was particularly interesting because a couple of things. One, based on the article, that might not actually be illegal. They might not actually be breaking the law. They might be allowed to fudge the numbers this way, the way it's written. And two, I think it goes to show how these kind of financial bubbles, which we're just out of the last one 10 years ago, how different factors work together to create them. Because what we're seeing right now is legally these companies are kind of inflating their earnings. And really, in the end, that inflation of earnings just creates these sort of financial bubbles and this financial instability. So I thought it was, you know, a particularly interesting way to show, you know, how this trend is developing in the U.S.
It really shows the limitations of regulations. I mean, you know, it's important to fight for regulations on these big banks and corporations, but there's just a certain internal drive that's just inherent. I mean, their job is to maximize profits. I mean, that's their legal obligation. There's always going to be just little ways that they can slowly wiggle out of, I mean, whatever restrictions, even if this is a restriction. I mean, you were saying it might be legal for them to say that, you know, 0.2 pennies is actually one penny. We have about 2 minutes left. Just comment on the nature of regulations in the financial industry.
Yeah, I think one really big thing to consider when we think about regulations is we think about the penalties. Because here's the thing, if a corporation makes, say, $20 million creatively rounding up, gets invested by a regulator, gets fined $5 million by the regulator, at the end of the day, the corporation will do the same thing again. Why not? They made $15 million. And so one of the problems with this regulatory structure is that the penalties and enforcement actions they have against financial institutions are extremely weak, and institutions have the best paid lawyers, the best lobbyists in the business, and they can fight those in court. They can reduce that $5 million fine to $2.5 million or something like that, and they can really get out from under it. And the problem we're having is the system is set up that they are not incentivized to play fair. They're incentivized to risk it because nobody's going to go to jail. Certainly in 2008, they didn't. And they're probably not going to be fined as much money as they actually made. They're going to come out ahead in the long run. So what's the point? And this really does show the limitations of regulation in this particular case. You know, it's important and it's necessary, but at the same time, it's really kind of been defanged and declawed in a lot of ways to where it's not able to effectively and, you know, hit them where it hurts to the point where they won't actually engage in this sort of activity regularly.
We've got 1 minute left, unfortunately. So let's talk really quickly about the president's threat of imposing a 20% tariff on European cars. He says it's because he wants more robust U.S. manufacturing of automobiles. I think that's probably not all true. I think it's probably that he wants to punish Europe for going nose to nose with him on this tariff issue. What do you think, Daniel?
Yeah, I think this shows a deeper fracturing of the relationship between us and our traditional union, European Union allies. That's a huge industry for them, and it really props up a tremendous part of their economy. If a 20% tariff was somehow to be put in place, that's effectively saying your number one customer, the United States, can no longer be your customer at all. And this will continue to deepen the rifts and will continue to have retaliatory measures till so the things like Harvey Davidson leaving will become much more common amongst other U.S. Companies as they're forced to kind of outsource to dodge tariffs. So this is really just an intensification of the trade war. And given how it's gone so far, I don't see any reason why not to think that he won't continue to move in this direction.
We're going to leave it right there. We've been joined from San Francisco by Daniel Sankey. He's a financial policy analyst. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.